Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you today live from St. Louis, Missouri in the United States. We're broadcasting from the studios of our friends and partners at St. Louis Public Radio, just down the road from the soaring steel of the city's famous Gateway Arch, the gateway to the West. It's long been a crossroads for people on the move, a melting pot of European and African American cultures with a rich tradition of music, blues, jazz and classical. And it is St. Louis, whatever Judy Garland may have sung. It's also part of America's Midwest, a key region as the country enters the final stretch of the presidential election campaign in early November. It is home to two battleground states and home to both vice presidential nominees. Well, later on, we'll be looking at what being a Midwesterner means for people in Missouri. But first, we're going to look at one of the most important issues nationally in this election, and one that's actually on the ballot here in November, access to abortion. And just to give you the context, in 2022, when the US Supreme Court overturned its landmark Roe versus Wade ruling that protected a woman's right to an abortion, Missouri became the first state to implement a near blanket ban on the procedure, the only exception being cases where the mother's life was in danger. Now, though, that could be about to change, even in this rock-solid Republican state. Voters here will be asked, assuming it gets the legal go-ahead today, if they want to amend the Missouri Constitution and restore that right to an abortion. That would end the need for women to travel to clinics outside the state, something thousands have had to do over the past 2 years. I've been hearing the experiences of one of them.
It was heart-wrenching. It was a Tuesday morning. It was like 9:45. I was absolutely in shock from the trauma. My world crumbled that day.
That's Erica, who lives on the other side of the state in the confusingly named Kansas City. A year and a half ago, she was given the news that no mother-to-be wants to hear.
I had a very wanted pregnancy, second pregnancy with my husband, and we went into our routine 20-week anatomy scan, so halfway through my pregnancy, when my doctor came in and told me my son, who we named Easton, had a fetal anomaly, and she went on to share what it meant if he survived. And so for us, thinking about our living child, thinking about Easton and his quality of life, thinking about our marriage, we did make the choiceless choice to seek an abortion.
And compounding that horrible situation was the fact that Missouri has an almost total ban on abortions. You live in Kansas City, Missouri. And therefore, were there big questions about how you were going to get the treatment, the abortion you needed? What was presented to you?
So when I got to maternal fetal medicine and they ran the additional tests, she told me where I could go. And it was a 10-hour car ride to Denver, Colorado, or a airplane to Washington, D.C. to be able to receive the health care that I needed, which was an abortion.
Erica, can I just ask you this finally? I mean, there are those on the other side of the argument who feel very passionately and very deeply about this issue, deeply opposed to abortion. They believe the sanctity of the fetus's life is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them?
I would say our decision was made out of immense motherly love and fatherly love. I did not want my child to suffer. Yeah, that means that I will forever miss him and grieve him and wish that things were different. But as a parent, aren't you supposed to protect your child? Aren't you supposed to love them, even if it means that you don't get what you want?
As we heard there from Erica, she had to go to Washington, D.C. to get the abortion she needed. For other women in St. Louis, the journey is much shorter, just across the Mississippi River from the city into another state, Illinois, where abortion is still legal. It just takes about 30 minutes across the bridge, and it's a journey we're going to do today. Well, with us on this journey across the river into Illinois is Jen Jester, midwife. And Jen, the reason you've come with us is because you have accompanied at least a couple of women on their journey into the next state to get an abortion.
The women that I've served are usually low resource and don't have much support. And so the few that I've accompanied over the river have needed an escort there and an advocate to make sure that they're getting to the right place, and also to make sure that they're emotionally and mentally protected when we arrive, because the security is tight, it's a gated facility, protesters can sometimes be hard to deal with, and so protecting their space and helping them get the care that they need, especially crossing state lines, can be a delicate matter.
Just turning into the clinic, there's a couple of people holding up placards, which it's difficult to know who the protesters are.
It is very hard to know. They look very official. They have their walkies and their vests on. They look very, very official.
And so they say they've got bibs saying clinic escort, but they're not clinic escorts.
These are clinic escorts right here.
The ones that are holding
the signs saying don't pay attention. They are protesters.
Oh, the ones at the gate with the protesters?
Yes, the ones right outside the gate.
I thought they were the official ones.
Right, because they look very official.
They look more official than the ones who are actually...
And they have their walkie-talkies pinned to the vest, and they're so happy to see you.
Gosh, that's very confusing. Good morning. We're from the BBC in London. Can we talk to you briefly about what you're doing in your protest? Do you mind?
This isn't a protest. We're offering these people free services.
Well, can we just ask you about that? You don't have to give your name or anything. We just want to know what's going on.
Talk to this woman. Unless our supervisor...
Well, as you heard there, they don't want to talk to us. They kept on insisting that they weren't protesters. They were just giving information to people coming into the clinic. But they're standing outside the clinic, and they definitely don't have anything to do with it. They did give us a card for a number to call to try and get permission so that they could speak to us. That number just rang out. Across the road, facing the clinic, we did find someone who was clearly a protester because we heard him shouting something over the fence earlier. He's now kneeling down right by the roadside. He's praying. I did gently go up to him and say, you know, would you mind speaking to us? He simply said, I just want to carry on praying.
Missouri became the first abortion-free state. Missourians have fought hard.
Opponents of Amendment 3, as the vote on restoring the right to an abortion in Missouri is known, are still battling in the courts and in the court of public opinion to get it struck off the ballot in November. That campaign has been led by Republican State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman.
I'm the architect of the Missouri law that is currently in place, so I think it's morally right. I think it is the position of many, many Missourians. But I'm also not blind, and I can see that there are people who do think that that is too extreme. But I believe that every life is sacred and that we should do everything we can to protect the unborn.
And where does that belief come from? Is it a religious belief?
Yeah, no, it's just basic science. I mean, the gametes meet, you are creating a unique individual human being, and they are due protection under the law, just as you and I are.
Is your position on abortion a vote loser for Republicans as we go into November?
No, I mean, listen, I think people are going to be looking at a broad range of issues and not just that one issue.
It's quite an important issue, though, isn't it? And all the polling suggests that a majority of Americans believe that there should be some access to abortion. And we've seen Donald Trump, for example, apparently
flip-flopping on where he stands on this issue, because he seems to be aware that actually this may cost him the election. Do you think that's true?
No, I think if you look at the history of what Donald Trump has done in this issue, it's been a little bit messy. Going back to the 2016 campaign, I think that, like most Americans, it's not his top issue. He's not paying attention to it at the same level. And so he'll say things and then he'll learn more and he'll say, you know what, actually, I was wrong on that.
Republican State Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman, an opponent of that amendment. Well, with me in the studio is Fred Ehrlich, politics editor at St. Louis Public Radio. Great to have you with us today on NewsHour. And Fred, the legal wrangling is continuing over this amendment right now and whether it will actually be on the ballot. Just bring us up to date.
Well, this thing is moving at warp speed. As a matter of fact, just 5 minutes before I walked into the studio, one of the reporters covering this told me that the Secretary of State, whose job it is to certify these ballot items, has decertified it. What that means right now, we don't know. Because did he decertify it because of the judge's ruling Friday, or did he decertify it because of something else? And the Supreme Court is set to rule on, have hearings on this tomorrow morning and make a ruling tomorrow on it. So it's very much up in the air.
But we should find out what within less than 24 hours.
Yes, absolutely.
If it is on the ballot, and it does seem to have a pretty decent chance of passing from what I understand, how come, given that this is such a Republican state? Just explain that to us.
Well, it's an interesting dichotomy we have in Missouri, because this has happened before. Voters here have approved ballot issues that are pro-union, raising the minimum wage, legalizing recreational marijuana, which, you know, if in most places are more of what I would call a liberal Democratic type position than a super conservative Republican position, which is what we have leading this state. And all the state offices are Republican, super majority in the state legislature. So it's a hard question to answer. In my experience, I would suggest a theory, and it's not unique to me, that people in this state, when they vote for their representative, state and federal, they tend to vote more on the personality and the overall platform and policies that person is going to put forward that would align more with them. But on these other issues that are directly affecting their lives, they tend to say, I think marijuana should be legalized, things like that.
I want to hear now a short clip of Wesley Bell. And this is from the night that he won the primary to contest the Safe Democrat seat of St. Louis in the House of Representatives. Let's just have a listen.
The number one killer of young black boys in this district is gun violence. We have an unhoused population that we need to address and make certain their needs are attended to and that the support that they need. We need to lower costs for prescriptions, for our seniors, but for all of our folks, to make sure that everyone has access to quality and affordable health care.
Fred, he won the primary ousting the incumbent after a pretty big bust-up. It's a long tale. But what was the essential dynamic there, and what does it say about politics here, do you think?
Well, I think the dynamic was it was a very close race, very contentious. But the thing that you just heard in that clip was Bell appealing to the concerns of the residents of the district. That is crime, housing, the economy. While his opponent focused more on national issues and more progressive issues. Not that Bell isn't a fairly liberal Democrat, but I think he appealed to what's really going on in people's daily lives and what they want their representative to be.
In a word, moving slightly towards the center?
Yes, absolutely.
Fred, thank you very much indeed. Fred
Thank Ehrlich, you for having me.
Politics editor here at St. Louis Public Radio. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. Much more coming up in just a moment here from Missouri. Still to come on NewsHour, we're going to be at a rodeo talking to people about what it means to be a Midwesterner and looking at why Missouri needs more immigrants, not fewer.
The number one issue that's facing Missouri are an aging state, declining births. But nobody wants to talk about that because that makes people scared. Those are things we can actually document. We can actually show empirically that the state's in demographic trouble.
That's coming up in 15 minutes. Let's just recap our main headlines from the BBC News from this hour. Germany's to place temporary controls on all its land borders to reduce irregular migration and protect the population against Islamist extremism. And the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, says she intends to stay in the country a day after her colleague, Edmundo González, went into exile. You're listening to NewsHour live from St. Louis with James Menendez. Well, with me in the studios here at St. Louis Public Radio is Lukas Kuntz, who's the Democratic Party's candidate for Senate in Missouri and hoping to unseat the Republican incumbent, Josh Hawley. Mr. Kuntz, very good to have you with us
here, James.
On NewsHour. Just briefly on the abortion issue. Lots of people want abortion rights restored, many of them living in the cities. Lots of other people in the state want to keep the ban. You have to aim to represent all of them. How do you as a candidate bridge that divide?
You know, my entire campaign is about taking power back for everyday people here in this state. You know, Fred mentioned a couple minutes ago how we've been doing that on ballot measures to protect unions, to increase the minimum wage, to make marijuana legal. And this is just another one of those cases, right? Everyday people in Missouri are smart. We're capable of making our own decisions. And my campaign is about empowering everyday people so that we have the ability to do that. This abortion issue is just another great example of that.
How, though, do you appeal to such a broad spectrum of opinion? I mean, isn't it the case that if you're running for statewide office in Missouri, you have to shift to the right?
Well, I'll tell you something about the Midwest here. You know, I grew up in a working-class neighborhood. My parents are your classic Missouri story. They got married at 19 and 22 years old. They were Catholic and followed the rules. So if you or your listeners know what that means, for us, that was kid, 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 and kind of the paycheck to paycheck lifestyle that went along with that. You know, my parents ultimately stopped after four kids because my little sister was born with a heart condition, had a bunch of surgeries, and, you know, being paycheck to paycheck, we ended up going bankrupt from that. The way that we made it through that time is because the people in our neighborhood, you know, who didn't have any more money than we did, they passed the plate down at my mom's prayer group for us. They brought more food by the house than we could eat. You know, they took me and my siblings into their houses for weeks at a time while my parents were off at these surgeries. Like, we have strength in our communities. We make good decisions when we have the ability to do it. And everybody here knows that. Everybody here feels that. And we just want to be able to make those decisions for ourselves. So, you know, I talk about that and everybody gets it, man.
I mean, I've just was looking earlier at your website. And I mean, you emphasize your long military service. And there's some images of you firing a gun, you on border patrol. I mean, these are all sort of hot topics for Republicans. I mean, it seems like pretty blunt messaging that you're saying, actually, you know, I may be a Democrat, but I'm perhaps not the Democrat that you think I am.
Well, I'm for national security. I'm for the values that I learned in my old neighborhood. But the thing that I'm not for is what guys like Josh Hawley are for. And that's for controlling us and deciding how we get to live our lives. Nobody in Missouri wants that. From, you know, the guy on the outskirts of town smoking weed on his back porch to the people in my old neighborhood, which, by the way, because of policies from guys like Josh Hawley, has completely fallen apart. You know, like, the first house I lived in is an empty lot. The one I joined the Marine Corps out of is boarded up to keep the squatters out. And it's just they've sold out to big corporations and taken power away from everyday people.
And yet Josh Hawley is, by most polls, 10 points ahead still.
You know, what we are doing is, I'm a nobody man, right? Like, I've come from a family with no money. I was a Marine for 13 years, deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan twice. And so what I need to do is introduce myself to the people in this state. And that's what we're doing right now. You know, I don't take any money from corporate PACs, no federal lobbyists, none of that. And still, we've raised enough money to get up on the airwaves. We're getting my message out there. And everywhere I go in the state, again, people understand my background. They know where I come from. They're coming over to our side. And they particularly want to do it because they know I'm the only guy who's going to give them power back.
Here's a question for you, especially as we've got the presidential debate tomorrow. Kamala Harris, if she were running in Missouri, she wouldn't have a chance, would she?
You know, you mentioned the debate. Fun thing, you got both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris willing to debate. I've accepted five debates in our race, and Josh Hawley's too afraid to do a single one of them. So I think
he says you're too afraid. I mean, that's what he accuses you of.
Well, I've agreed to five of them, so I don't know where the guy is.
So why hasn't it happened?
I even said I'd do one on Fox News if the guy needed a safe space, you know. But so far, it's crickets. We've just had a couple more deadlines pass. I agreed to each one, and he didn't agree to any of them.
But just back to Kamala Harris. I mean, from your campaign's point of view, is she a blessing or a curse?
Well, you know, I think the top of the ticket here in Missouri is really, it's not going to be the presidential race. You're not going to see, you know, really national people from either side coming in here. So the top of the ticket in Missouri is going to be my Senate race and the abortion petition. And so,
I mean, Josh Hawley says you haven't formally endorsed her. I mean, have you? Are you willing to endorse her formally and say, look, she's the one to lead us forward?
I'm getting all around this state trying to get people to vote for me. I think that's a pretty big job in and of itself. I'm proud to be doing that job, and I'm just going to continue to ask everyone to vote for me.
Is that a yes or a no? I mean, will you endorse her?
No, I'm telling you exactly what my print plan is.
What?
To get everybody to vote for me, man.
Yeah, but what about Kamala Harris? Should people vote for her?
Again, you know, I think they should vote for me, and I'm willing to work with any Democrat or Republican, whether president or outside of that, to bring money back to this state and to give people their rights back.
Okay, Mr. Kuntz, thank you very much indeed. Lucas Kuntz, who's the Democratic Party's candidate for the Senate here in Missouri in those elections, of course, in November. We have been trying, I should say, for 2 weeks to persuade Senator Hawley to come on this program too, but without success. We're going to move away from here for a few minutes. We're going to head to Vietnam because huge amounts of rain from Super Typhoon Yagi have caused devastation across parts of the country. More than 60 people are reported to have been killed, with landslides and flooding bringing down bridges and sweeping away vehicles. Nguyen Le is a freelance journalist, and she's based in the capital, Hanoi.
As soon as I left my house to the city center, I saw lots of fallen trees, and I think I've never seen anything like that before. In such a big scale, and I saw like very big old trees, some like historical trees of Hanoi fallen down on the streets. And it's very painful to see that, because to Hanoi people, the trees are very important. The trees are our pride and our signature.
It's also been devastating for human life. As I understand it, a bridge collapsed. A bus was swept away by the flooding. What more can you tell us about that? What's being reported there?
Yeah, so the bridge collapsed in the northern province, not far from Hanoi. And luckily, later on during the day, there were updates, and they found three survivors. They were on the bridge, and when they heard a very loud noise, they thought it was a big truck coming. But as soon as they realized that though it wasn't a truck coming, they were falling down. And the two guys on the motorbike luckily somehow found themselves, got caught on the column that support the bridge, and people came and rescued them. And they kind of passed down, and they realized that, oh, they didn't die. Then there is another guy who dropped into the water, and very luckily he found a banana tree. So he grabbed on those banana trees and he floats for like 3-4 kilometers down the river, and then got rescued.
And what about the situation at the moment? Have there been power cuts? Have you got electricity in Hanoi?
In Hanoi, it's different in different areas. Like, for example, at my house, the power stay on, the internet stay on. But some of my friends I know live in the other area of Hanoi had power cuts. And some of my team member who stay in Haiphong, which is the province that near the shore, has been hit very severely. And they have no electricity and no clean water and no internet since the storm hit on Saturday. So they've been living in like out of connection with the rest of the world for long hours.
And you said that you'd never seen anything like it. Are people that you've been speaking to, are they scared by what happens, worried that this is the sort of storm that Vietnam might expect in the years to come?
I think at the moment we're still very much in shock, and we're very much looking at what happened and have to find ways to clean up. It takes a lot of time, and also have discussion with friends what might happen in the future. And we talk about climate change and what will be the solutions. You know, it's very sad to see all this and the damage and the pain that people have to go through.
Nguyen Le in Vietnam. You're listening to NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour. Ukraine's surprise incursion into Russia's Kursk region last month may have boosted the nation's morale, but its forces are on the back foot along key parts of the front line at home. In eastern Ukraine, troops are digging in to hold on to the strategically important city of Pokrovsk. The fighting is now just 8 kilometres away, prompting thousands of civilians to flee. The BBC's Abdul Jalil Abdul Rasulov has been with soldiers in the area, and sent us this report.
Soldiers of the 15th Brigade of the Ukrainian National Guard rushed to their artillery installation. They operate near the town of Selidove in eastern Ukraine and have just received an order to open fire. Their gun is an old American howitzer, M101. This same type of weapon was used in World War II. Now, Ukrainian forces rely on it to stop Russian troops. And lately, Russian attacks in their area have been relentless, as Dmytro, commander of the unit, explains.
The fighting is very intense. We fire up to 200 rounds a day. The enemy continues their attacks in small groups, sometimes up to 60 people. They're trying to break through our defensive lines, so we provide cover to our infantry.
15 kilometers west of Selidove is Pokrovsk. This city is a major transportation hub in eastern Ukraine, essential for delivering food, weapons and soldiers to the front line. Moscow's objective is to seize this city and cut off the supply route. The authorities urge local residents to get out while they still can. 69-year-old Maria Goncharenko heeds this advice and signs up for evacuation. Volunteers in blue bulletproof vests arrive to pick her up from an old Soviet apartment block. They take her to an assembly point and help to board the bus. Trains no longer run here. The volunteers put her back in a basket with two kittens next to her. Do I need to pay? Maria asks them. No, she's assured. It's all free of charge. Then she bursts into tears.
We lived peacefully, worked until retirement. And look at what Russians did to us. I curse Putin.
Do you know where you're going to? I ask.
No, but the most important thing is to get out of this city.
That report from eastern Ukraine by the BBC's Abdul Jalil Abdurasulov. You're listening to the BBC. This is the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour, and we're broadcasting today live from the studios of our friends at St. Louis Public Radio in the US state of Missouri, just a couple of miles away from the astonishing Gateway Arch, which sits on the bank of the Mississippi River. Now, the arch may be the gateway to the West, but we're still in the Midwest here, a region sometimes derided as flyover country. But for much of the 20th century, it was the engine room of the American economy. And now it may hold the key to the outcome of November's presidential election. It is home to two crucial swing states, Wisconsin and Michigan, and home to both vice presidential nominees. Well, let's hear from both of them now. For Kamala Harris and the Democrats, it's Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota. But first, Donald Trump's running mate, the Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
I grew up in Middletown, Ohio, a small town where people spoke their minds, built with their hands, and loved their God, their family, their community, and their country with their whole hearts. But it was also a place that had been cast aside and forgotten by America's ruling class in Washington.
Now, I grew up in Butte, Nebraska. Growing up in a small town like that, you learn how to take care of each other. That family down the road, they may not think like you do, but they're your neighbors. And you look out for them. And they look out for you.
So a similar folksy tone from both. But of course, behind that, two very different visions. But what do people here want from their politicians? And what are Midwesterners really like? We began our quest about an hour outside St. Louis on a warm late summer evening for some beer, burgers and bucking broncos at a rodeo in the wonderfully named town of Defiance.
Folks, he wants to be on the sidelines to be at the top
We drink soda, not pop. We have pork steaks, toasted raviolis. We live in Missouri, not Missouri.
I've got to ask you about toasted raviolis, because they're not really toasted. They're deep fried, aren't they?
Only in Missouri, buddy.
My name's Caleb Guns, and I'm a hat shaper here in St. Peter's, Missouri, is where we're based out of. We take the hats, we fit them to the head, we mark everybody's center line. Everybody's head's a little different, so we mark the center line on their eyebrows, and then we steam them out. So we always start the steaming with the crown, which is the top of the head. We have a really strong root of values and morals, and you have a tendency to see like a sense of community more, I think, in the Midwest. And I think a lot of people still yearn for that. Days gone by, simple life, neighbors looking out for each other, and it's just that sense of like we're all in this together, and in cities you don't have that.
I think we're good people, at least for me. I know I try to find the good in everybody. Polite, there's no reason to be mean or rude. I mean, there's just, life's too short.
Need you here, I need you now. I need to feel you up against my skin.
In the cities you get that polarization, but when you get outside the cities, everybody's either, you know, a good person, you work hard, strong work ethic, and that's really the difference. And when you say you're a Midwesterner, it really means something here in the States. And that is, there's that genuine ethic, and you've been raised with it. You've been raised to work hard. You earn what you get. You're not given anything, and that I think that means a lot.
Can't wait till the moment I see you again. So don't be gone long, 'cause I...
The cowboy hats and boots feel like a world away from St. Louis, but the link is the man who's put on the rodeo, Billy Bush, one of the heirs to the Budweiser beer fortune. The family brewery, now sold off, is still in the city, and the family name is everywhere. But Billy prefers life out here in the country.
It's a great place to grow up. It's where my great-grandfather landed when he came over from Europe. It's where our roots are, and it's where my family built an incredible business.
A world-famous business, yes. Budweiser beer, of course. How do you feel? We're coming up to an election in November. The Midwest is front and center of this campaign for both parties. Both the vice presidential candidates are from the Midwest. I mean, is it gratifying that people are paying attention to the Midwest? Because often people say that they feel a bit forgotten by whether it's Washington or people on the coast, LA, New York. I mean, is that fair?
I think the Midwest, it's very important for the candidates. Missouri's a red state.
Yeah, nothing's going to change here, is it?
I don't think anything's going to change here. You know, we have conservative values here. The values of hard work and faith are born here in the Midwest, really are.
Can we talk a bit about immigration? It's a big topic in this election. I mean, your family story, of course, is one of immigration in the 19th century from Germany. And your forefathers saw the potential, as you say, of this land. What does that have to tell us about, you know, what's happening today?
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with immigrants. That's what this country was founded on. It's just how immigrants come into our country. Are they coming in legally or are they coming in illegally? Legally, immigration's great. I totally believe in it.
I mean,
if it wasn't for immigration, yeah. I wouldn't be here.
The word immigrant is sort of politicized, it's weaponized, and it creates this idea that an immigrant is a bad thing. Is there a danger there?
There is a danger there, and illegal immigration seems to be giving all immigrants a bad name these days, and it shouldn't be that way. But unfortunately, with the borders being left open, as they have been under the current administration, the immigrants, now all immigrants seem to have suffered from it.
And is Donald Trump then the man to do that?
I think for sure he's the man to do that. I think, you know, his policies on immigration, on the economy, on our world affairs, we need him back in the Oval Office to run this country again.
He's been very divisive, though, and coming here, and I haven't been here very long, but
right. People
are really nice here. They're really friendly. They're really welcoming. It seems a world away from the sort of divisive rhetoric we've heard from him, and we heard from him when he was president, and the sort of polarization we've seen in this country. I mean, how does America come back from that, do you think?
Midwesterners need to understand that sometimes saying it like it is not such a bad thing, and being forthright. Now, I know a lot of people can't handle that, and that's what's gotten Donald Trump into trouble. But I respect the man for working as hard as he does. The way he continues to fight with all this that is against him, the media, the FBI, trials and judges and law cases, he keeps on going. That's what a fighter's made of.
On the issue of immigration, it's worth saying that Missouri desperately needs more people to come and work here. St. Louis, in particular, is one of the fastest shrinking cities in the country. But in a red state, solidly Republican, that's not a message you're likely to hear in the run-up to the election, says Professor Ness Sandoval of St. Louis University.
The number one commercial you'll see on TV today is that Missouri has an immigrant problem. And that's simply not the case. Our number, we have 0.5%, this is the highest estimate of undocumented immigrants of the country live here. It's like 75,000, that's nothing. The number one issue that's facing Missouri are an aging state, declining births. But nobody wants to talk about that because that makes people scared. Those are things we can actually document. We can actually show empirically that the state's in demographic trouble.
Ness Sandoval of St. Louis University. Well, I've been discussing some of that with two seasoned observers of the political scene here, Mark Reardon, conservative talk show host, and Jane Duker, former Democratic Party advisor in Missouri, and both regular sparring partners on the airwaves.
There's a big difference between legal and illegal immigration. I'll give you an example. Last year, we were at a baseball game at Busch Stadium. They had, before the national anthem, a bunch of people who went through the process, became citizens. Everybody cheered. It was a proud moment. You get emotional. But that's different than what's happened at the border.
And yet, again, as we've heard, illegal immigration in this state in particular isn't that big a problem. The numbers are pretty small.
That's kind of a moot point, because what we're seeing is what's happening to the country overall. We don't want what's happening in New York, Chicago, Denver. No way in hell.
Jane, is the national debate over immigration distorting local issues over immigration?
I think it is. The best example that you can see in St. Louis is the Bosnian community, that they all fled, came here, and set up an incredible community. And they are a very big part of the fabric of St. Louis. And so we are losing population. Everyone agrees that you don't want unfettered access. But what we're finding is there's not really any reasonable access or ability to get naturalized in this country. We certainly do not have a balance there. And St. Louis is desperate for workers. It's not only is the city losing population, they're losing families. And you can't have a vibrant urban core without families.
Let's talk about those two different perspectives. I mentioned that both vice presidential candidates come from the Midwest, different sorts of backgrounds. Let me ask you first about J.D. Vance, Donald Trump's running mate. What is his vision of the Midwest? What is he trying to sell? What is he bringing to the campaign, do you think?
I think he comes off as a real person who can relate to people who have economic struggles and beyond because of his story. J.D. Vance brings the opportunity for a purple state to go red and put Donald Trump back in the White House. That's what he brings.
And what's Tim Walz bringing to the Democrats and Kamala Harris's campaign?
Yeah, Jane.
I think he is bringing approachability. I mean, he's a coach, a teacher. He wants to bring everything up for everybody. And I think that's a message that's resonating with a lot of people. He definitely is a foil to her, where she's more California coast. He's very likable. It's hard to hate the guy.
I don't think people are making their decision on either of those vice presidential candidates. I really don't.
I agree.
But do politicians pay lip service to the Midwest, Midwestern values, and then when the election's over, they just sort of walk away?
A Missouri Republican is different than a California Republican or a New York Republican. Those people are responsible for getting the Republicans in the majority in Congress. So you have to understand differences. I think Jane would agree that there's a lot of people that are, it's my way or the highway, no compromise. That's not me. I think it's important to have coalitions. We're okay with being a flyover state if it means that Republicans are in office. I'll make that sacrifice.
It's sort of interesting, though. I mean, we used to be a bellwether state, and we've lost that. In Missouri, you have a very red statewide electeds. Our legislature is extremely red. But yet, when Medicaid's on the ballot, it passes. The abortion has a very good chance of passing in Missouri. We have marijuana. So when it comes to issues, Missourians can be far less partisan. What I worry about as a Democrat is that the issues are not what people are looking at. It's a personality. I'm not sure that they really get, other than the urban core, I don't think they get any play in Missouri.
Final question. The debate tomorrow, how much hinges on that for Donald Trump? How crucial is it for him, Mark?
I think it's very important because the race has changed dramatically in the last 8 weeks. I think there's a lot on the line, and the question is, can Kamala Harris be someone?
No. The question for Donald Trump is, what's he got to do? Is he on the back foot?
I don't think he has to do anything except for stay engaged, I'll be honest with you. So I'm not as worried about Trump. I want to see what Kamala does.
There's a lot riding on it for her, isn't there?
Oh, there absolutely is.
I mean, this could be a pivot point in the campaign.
It absolutely is. I mean, this is where does she step up and does she look presidential? I mean, I think that's what people are looking at. People say, oh, I want to hear more about policy. I don't think that's what people want to see. I think they want, can she stand toe-to-toe with Donald Trump?
Jane Duker and Mark Reardon. And just to let you know, there is a special edition of the NewsHour podcast available now, looking in a bit more detail about what sets the Midwest apart and the significance of the region as we head into November's presidential election. Just search for BBC NewsHour wherever you get your podcasts and you'll find it there. But do stay with us on this edition of the programme. Still more to come. We're going to move away from the United States now and head to Afghanistan, because people there are facing unprecedented levels of hunger, and as ever, it is children that are suffering the most. More than 3 million children under the age of 5 are already malnourished, and in half of them, that's stunting their growth. Cuts to aid and the Taliban's policy, specifically its restrictions on women, have led to a significant drop in funding to public health programs. And as the BBC has discovered, that's causing a sharp rise in child mortality. From Jalalabad in eastern Afghanistan, the BBC South Asia correspondent Yogita Limai sent us this report, and a warning, her report does contain some distressing accounts.
I'm in the main regional hospital in Jalalabad, which is the capital of Nangarhar province in the east of Afghanistan. I'm seeing in front of me just a sea of people who are coming in, bringing in their sick children. And what we've been told is that every day, on an average, about 600 children come here who need to be treated in a hospital, but there are only 120 beds. Even the facilities that are operating, those are being supported at the moment by international aid organizations. But in the past couple of years, we've seen dramatic aid cuts. What we're witnessing in front of us is a direct impact of that cut in aid, and it's also the impact of the Taliban government's policies, especially their restrictions on women, which have resulted in some donors cutting funds to Afghanistan. I'm in the room where they're treating children with severe acute malnutrition. I've counted 7 beds and 18 babies. And from what doctors here are telling us, this is not some kind of a seasonal increase. This is now what they see regularly here.
7-month-old Hajira Bibi is the size of a newborn baby. She wears a long red T-shirt, her legs are bare and stick-like. 6 of her siblings have died, and now she's battling for her life. Her mother, Amina, looks despondent.
This is like doomsday for me. I've suffered so much. I feel so much grief. Can you imagine what I've gone through watching my children die? It is because of poverty. All I can feed them is dry bread and water that I warm up by keeping it out under the sun.
One of the babies we've just been shown is in a critical condition.
The most complicated case in ICU.
She's a 1-year-old baby girl. Her name is Asma. And she's got a little oxygen mask attached to her nose and mouth. She's gasping for breath. She's not blinking. Doctors have told us that they don't think this baby will survive. Her mum is sitting beside her. Nasiba has already lost 3 children. I feel like the flesh is melting from my body. I can't bear to see her suffering like this, she says, breaking down into sobs. The doctor tells us Asma might go into cardiac arrest soon. We leave the room. Less than 2 hours later, she died.
We've just come back to the malnutrition ward after a couple of hours that we were in another part of the hospital. And we've been given the news that baby Asma has died. And in her place, in the little half a bed that she laid left empty, I can see already another child who looks severely malnourished. I'm told this is baby Alia, 3 months old. But this is what it's like here. before the people in this room, the nurses, the doctors, before anyone really has any time to register or recover from the grief of a child dying right here in front of their eyes, another one has to be brought in because there are just so many sick children in need. You hear of the statistics, you hear 10% of all children in Afghanistan are malnourished, that a million are at risk of dying. But this is what it's like in front of your eyes. Within a couple of hours, a baby's dead. Another really sick child in her place. I've come to a settlement outside of Jalalabad. It's a rural area, barren tracts of land, and you can see tall mountains in the background. And there are lots of small mud and brick homes here. We've been walking around this area with a health worker, and literally every lane that we've passed through, she's identified at least one house that has children who are suffering from malnutrition. And there are lots of children that we're seeing here who are also facing stunting, so they're not the right height for their age. We're going to meet one such family right now. Muhammad is two, much shorter than he should be at that age. And he's also not able to stand up yet, his mother, Rubina, says.
The doctor has told me that if he gets treatment for the next 3 to 6 months, he will be fine. But we can't even afford food. How do we pay for the treatment? I'm scared he will become disabled and he will never be able to walk. I have fear in my heart.
Nearly half of all children under the age of 5 are stunted, according to UNICEF. That's alarming for Afghanistan's future generations. Stunting can lead to irreversible physical and mental damage. But children like Muhammad can recover if they're treated before it's too late. Timely intervention can save Afghanistan's children from death and disability.
That was our South Asia correspondent, Yogita Limai, reporting from Afghanistan. Well, Richard Bennett is the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Afghanistan. He told us the Taliban had become increasingly hardline since returning to power in 2021.
Their rhetoric and their actions have changed. When they were talking in Doha before they got back into power, and even when they took over power, they gave certain guarantees, or close to guarantees. They said that girls' schools would reopen. They said that they would abide by the international human rights treaties, provided they weren't in contradiction to Sharia. They said that there would be a general amnesty for those who fought against them. There's a massive gap between their rhetoric and their actions. And in fact, their actions have got much harsher, and their rhetoric has matched it, because now they are saying that these are internal matters. They're claiming sovereignty over issues like this. So they've hardened. Whether or not they were genuine at the beginning, I don't want to comment on, but certainly the evidence is that they have taken the fork in the road, which leads back to the very stark era of the 1990s. And the most recent example being the passing of what they call a law on the prevention of vice and the promotion of virtue, which includes even more draconian measures on women and girls. Not even women's voices can be heard in public anymore. And also a big impact possibly on the media, because they are banning the images of human beings. Fine for radio, but how do you do TV?
Richard Bennett. Well, that is it for this special edition of NewsHour from Missouri. My thanks to our partners at St. Louis Public Radio and, of course, the BBC teams here and in London. Thank you so much for listening. Until the next time, bye-bye.
Eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is know who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.